play it once, Sam. For all time's sake.
I don't know what you mean, Miss Elsa.
Play it, Sam. Play as time goes by.
Oh, I can't remember it, Miss Elsa. I'm a little rusty on it.
I'll hum it for you. Sing it, Sam.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
Casablanca, coming up next. Haven't Seen It with Tim Sestito and Tommy Tevenick. Hello, everybody. Welcome on in. Thank you all so much for listening today. This is a podcast where one of us is watching a movie for the very first time. And today that is Tommy.
Yeah, never seen Casablanca.
We got Valentine's Day coming up and you were like, let's watch Hail Caesar. Like, this is the time to do Hail Caesar. I'm like, okay, yeah. And then I was just thinking, because I was looking at the Regal Cinema. They're doing a whole schedule release of a bunch of, you know, old classics. Like, every day it's a new romance movie. Yeah. And on Valentine's Day, they're pulling out the big guns. They're pulling out Casablanca. And I was just like, Tommy, have you ever seen Casablanca? And you're just like, nah. And I was like, oh, okay, we're doing it.
What's so funny is that we've been doing this podcast for 4 years, and pretty much like the whole premise of the podcast was, let's like cover like classics we haven't seen before and everything like that. And it took us 4 years to get there to list off some movies that we covered before this, before Casablanca. And it was like one of the greatest movies.
We covered Darkman before this.
Yeah, we covered Darkman before this. We covered like Final Destination before this. We covered like Return of the Living Dead, the Evil Dead remake.
You know,
all these other movies. And eventually it's like, okay, I guess we'll get to Casablanca. And now we're knocking off a huge one off the list.
Yeah. You know, for me, I'm almost glad that we're now at a point that we can, like, I feel like this is one of those really easy ones that we could have covered immediately, being like, oh, it's one of the best. Oh, it's a big name. Just throw it on there. But like, I don't know if we were going to be ready to have like a good enough conversation at the start of this podcast. You know what I mean? Like, I'm glad we're at a point now where the podcast is actually good. Yeah, you need some reps to get to Casablanca, okay? You don't want Casablanca to be your first one. Like, Scrooged is a perfect second episode because no one cares. You know, it's like, it's one of those movies.
That's why we talked about Reality Bites like 2 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. We covered the perks of being a wallflower. Okay. We
earned our Casablanca stripes.
we earned our Casablanca stripes. Okay. We were grinding podcasts. Okay, man, we were in the mud. All right.
Yeah.
We were out there. We were doing 2 days.
We were in the trenches. We were guesting on some weird podcasts.
And now we're ready for D-Day, you know, like that's what happens. Yeah, Tommy, for you, like, how did you just, like, I know you had, especially before this podcast, like, I feel like now you have a bit more of an appreciation for older films, but, like, like, was it just the fact that it was from 1942 and you just were like, nah?
I think it's just that I had so much more interest in, like, 80s, 90s movies and like, even 70s movies that, like, going back to the 1940s was never really on my radar. When I was looking back on shit. And then I think I had a stigma for a bit that was like older movies just like kind of suck. Like, there's not as much like camera movement and stuff like that. Everything's static. I don't like the way they talk. Like, I hate the transatlantic accent and all that.
I like the transatlantic accent. I don't know.
I it's warmed up to me. But at the time, like, I was like, especially when I was younger, like, oh, this is hokey type bullshit. Especially like my mom used to watch TCM a lot. And sometimes I love TCM. Other times I was like, what old bullshit are they playing right now?
Yeah, and they're all like very curated. Like that film list is always like incredibly curated, and like sometimes it's just like a random deep cut from 1944, you know?
Yeah. And it's so funny now that like when you pull on like HBO, if you pull certain movies, I'm sure Casablanca is one of them, they'll start off with a TCM thing. And for a movie like Casablanca, they didn't do it?
No, they did it on the HBO thing. We just had some Jewish guy just talking to me about Casablanca, like giving no actual insight into it other than like, this is one of the greatest movies of all time.
Yeah.
And then it's a plot synopsis, and then just goes into the movie. He's like, cool, like, I didn't need this. Like, we'll just get the movie going.
This didn't help. It's funny, like, now when you pulled up, it's like Gremlins, and then Ben Mankiewicz talking about Gremlins.
Yeah, that's who it was. It was Ben Mankiewicz, yeah. I was just like, how do I get this guy's job? I could do a better job than this. Like,
well, first of all, you have to be the son of Mank himself, or grandson, rather.
Yeah, that might help. If I wrote one of the greatest screenplays, and my grandfather wrote one of the greatest screenplays in the history of Hollywood, and then had a whole movie, which was okay, dedicated to it. Yeah, I think you could maybe get away with that. But otherwise, no.
Mm.
No, you can't. So, I mean, just like broad impressions for you, because like you had to have known a lot of, at least the lines of this movie. Like there's just so many iconic lines from Casablanca that
it's one of those things that I almost expected Here's Looking at You, Kid to be more of just like a overall Humphrey Bogart catchphrase than like specifically tied to this movie.
and specifically tied to Ilsa, like specifically.
Yeah. And speaking of which, this is my first Humphrey Bogart movie.
Really?
Never seen a Humphrey Bogart. Again, like I said, like old movies never been my bag as much. But I see the charm immediately. And there's other movies I want to see. I want to see that one where he's like a mean librarian and for a drink.
Maltese Falcon? And
I think that's a Maltese Falcon. Because that scene always pops up on Twitter where it's Humphrey Bogart. And just like all of a sudden he's talking to the librarian and she lets down her hair and glasses. He's like, oh, hello.
Yeah, you know, he's got, you know, it was funny when we were on last week and we were discussing Casablanca at the very end of the episode. It was like, oh, like, it's a little hokey, like Humphrey Bogart just becomes a miserable guy because he lost the love of his life. And I'm like, you know what, if I fumbled the bag on Prime Ingrid Bergman, like, I get it. You know what I mean? Like, that's tough. That's a tough one to live. That's a tough one to live with. No real explanation, just a note. And I don't post a ton of Letterboxd reviews, but I posted a Letterboxd review for this one. And I said, no one has looked cooler getting their heart broken than Humphrey Bogart as Rick, crumpling a stained letter and standing in the doorway of a train pulling out of the station. Like, I'm like, that's the coolest fucking guy ever.
We've gotten to the part in the podcast where we start quoting our Letterboxd reviews.
Yes. Yeah. Go follow us on Letterboxd.
Yeah. Now that we're critics, we have a Letterboxd account.
Yeah, very legitimate.
No. But I know you mean, like, for me going into it, like when I hear like a 1930s, 1940s movie, I usually don't get too excited. But this one I can see immediately why it was a classic. On broad strokes, cinematography, incredible.
Unbelievable.
Like,
yeah.
Really great for the time. Like, it's a point that like you're shocked that they had this much movement of a camera. It made me wonder, like, I don't think the dolly was even invented back then. So like there's so many things where like, they just like zoom in on the characters right in the beginning of the scene, start out in like the wide shot of the room and then slowly just move the camera in. That felt like groundbreaking for the other stuff we've seen from the 1930s and 40s on the show.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough. Like one day, because it was funny, I watched this movie twice in preparation for this, because I'm like, I'm going to be prepared for Casablanca. Like, this is a big dog. And watched it once with my girlfriend. And as soon as we finish, we're watching it on HBO. And the next thing that pops up is Gone with the Wind. And she's like, okay, like, I do want to watch that, but we're going to have to watch that in multiple viewings. So I'm like, there's going to be a time that I am going to torture Tommy and I'm going to make him watch Gone with the Wind. Like, I'm going to do it to you at some point. Like,
it's going to happen.
And like, I don't want to sit here and say like all of this stuff is, it's all just like kind of matriculates together, especially in like an art format, like film. They talk about Silence, which is like what is it? Sunrise. It's a silent film from like 1927, and that is acclaimed as being like one of the like revelations of modern cinematography, just putting in a lot of like effects and just like the camera movement just really didn't exist at that time. Like when you're thinking back, like you're kind of thinking back to like silent films. And I think it's interesting too, because when you look at a lot of like I was watching a documentary or whatever promotional material for Casablanca, and they're talking about it, and you know, like the preface being like all these these were film factories. It was, they basically took the Industrial Revolution, the Henry Ford method of being like, how can we print as many of these things out as possible? And they would release like 50 movies a year. Mm-hmm. So Casablanca was just a slate of 1 in 50. It didn't really have this like high regard going into it. And we'll obviously discuss more of like the production and kind of like those prevailing thoughts, but like, Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman like thought it was going to be a sticker. Like they didn't have the iconic ending figured out, which ends up probably playing into like the performances better, where they didn't have that love triangle resolved at the end. They didn't know which way it was going to go. Was she going to leave? Was she going to stay in Casablanca or leave with Laszlo and go with her husband? Like it wasn't really defined yet. Mm-hmm. I think another interesting thing is that this is a war propaganda film.
It's insane to me to think that like this movie was going on, was while the movie was going on, while the war was going on rather. Yeah, 1942 and the war.
Well, the war started in 39. France falls in 40, and this takes place days before Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. It takes place in early December 1941. And it's just this, like, it's magic. I think it's very much lightning in a bottle, just kind of capturing all of this. It's got an excellent, like, the screenplay feels very contemporary. Like the dialogue is so witty and just everything that comes out of these characters' mouths just feels organic. And it's like rides that corny line so well, but it just never really falls into that camp ever. And it's more sentimental than anything. I mean, they bring up Rick being a sentimentalist the entire time throughout the movie. It's remarkable to me that this is one of those, you know, there's that classic William Friedkin and who was he? Was it Aronofsky? I think he was sitting there interviewing Darren Aronofsky, and Aronofsky was like being his pretentious self, shitting on this movie. And Friedkin looks at him and be like, how many movies from 1942 can you name? You can't. Like, this, like when a movie hits that level, like no matter what, like you can, I think you can nitpick any movie that you really want to, if you really want to blow your brain out of your head and try to find, like, they're always going to be there, but I don't think, like, when a movie hits that timeless standard, and then you're able to go back into it, I just think it kind of learns to exist in that plane of timeless. Well, like, this movie is timeless.
Yeah, yeah. To the point, like, I was looking at just real quick at, like, other 1942 movies, and the only other one I can, like, say I've probably seen or, like, really know of off the top of my head is Bambi. Cartoon movie. So there's a lot of pressure of us like riding on the fact we're covering Casablanca, because this is one of the totem greats, to the point that in my procrastination nature, I only finished this movie 20 minutes before we started recording.
Yeah, love so, to hear it.
Still very fresh thoughts off the top of my head.
Yeah, you're...
That's the haven't seen the experience.
Yeah, so like this is, I don't know, sixth or seventh time I've seen this movie.
Oh, wow.
Probably my favorite viewing I got at the New York City Film Forum. Right off Houston Street, they had a 1942 print of this movie. So I got to watch it on an original printing of this, which was a very, very cool experience. It definitely plays better in a theater. I don't know. It's just, it is just, that's just the move, the cinematic experience, right? It'll always play better in a movie theater. Mm. But there's lots to talk about with this movie. Let's do a quick little, what did you watch? What did you watch this week, Tommy? Give me something good.
Hey, I'll give you a quick one that actually ties into this movie. In my procrastination nature, while not watching Casablanca, I watched a movie where characters watch Casablanca.
Oh.
Just reminded me, like, oh, shit, I got to watch Casablanca this week.
I like how you can't escape your nature of just being like, oh, but I still got to watch this movie from 1942. I'm just, push it off.
Yeah. It's still in there. I've watched three movies in between Monday and today when we're recording. One I want to talk about is called Good Rich. It's with Michael Keaton. It came out like about 2 years ago. And basically it's like Michael Keaton is a guy in his like early 70s, as Michael Keaton is. And he's learning to reconnect with his daughter, Mila Kunis, who's like in her late 30s, having a kid. And he also at the same time has his kid, parent to like young kids.
Yeah.
So he has to navigate that, like, and like the fact that his wife is in rehab, not wanting to talk with him. And it wasn't anything like super special, but there's one scene in the movie where Michael Keaton was like talking to his young kids that are like, I don't know, like age like 5 and 6. He's like, oh, you guys haven't seen Casablanca before? And it's like, yeah, we're gonna watch Casablanca. They have a movie night, they show Casablanca, and they pretty much just show like the opening credits and the end credits. He's like, oh, that was a great movie, wasn't it? Those were a time I was like, motherfucker, I have to get ready for this fucking podcast. And here I am watching Goodrich, random like Michael Keaton movie from like the 2020s. I didn't need to watch, but overall, it's a charming time. I mean, it's not anything special, but it kind of is like one of those movies you'd see a lot more like 10 years ago.
Mm.
Just like the indie drama that has like a few people you might have recognized. For example, in this case, I had Michael Keaton, I had Mila Kunis, and I had Andy McDowell and Kevin Pollak showing up. So it was just a breezy comedy.
Yeah.
And just Michael Keaton being an old guy, just like figuring out like life and stuff like that and what's going on. Him getting hit on by a neighbor that, or another classmate of his, their parent, thinking he's gay or anything like that. So shit like that. But there's the Casablanca scene. And I was like, ah, great.
You're like, great. Just a timely reminder. Pretty much the only reason to even bring it up on this podcast, it sounds like.
Yeah.
But yeah, I watched John Wick 1 and 2. And
nice.
I don't know. Just they were on HBO and I saw them there and I just said like I have other movies I need to watch. Like I need to catch up on some of the Oscar noms. Like I have a whole backlog, but then I just see John Wick 1 and 2 show up and I'm just like, yeah, this is the one. I'm going to watch this movie. And you don't really have a say in it. Just like truly like the best action sequences in movies. Like I know, especially with 3 and 4, they're a little long, but just like when you're in the heart of the action there, it's just, I'm just like, yes, this is,
let's go.
You know what? This is what AI can never do. AI can never make this.
Reconnect the John Wick action.
Yeah, and
I know what you mean. Those movies rock and they really flow into each other really well. I remember last year I did a sick day at work where I was like fighting off a cold. And I was like, you know what? I'm sick. I'm going to watch all three, first three John Wick movies. And I had a blast just from like start to finish.
Oh, yeah.
Because they just compound to each other where each one starts where the last one just ended.
Yeah, no, they're great back-to-back movies. And perhaps maybe a movie people will be discussing in 80 years from now. I don't know. Yeah. But speaking of movies from 80 years ago, this is Casablanca.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine.
Been a long time.
Announcing the 50th anniversary collector's edition video of Casablanca.
Play it once, then, for all time's sake.
He's looking at you, kid.
Casablanca, $19.98 or less after $5 mail-in rebate with purchase of Taster's Choice.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Casablanca.
19.
I knew you would love that VHS TV spot. That's why I picked it for you. Because, you know, TV didn't exist when Casablanca came out. Fun fact. Casablanca.
I mean, hey.
Yep.
I can get Casablanca on 4K for $5 less than that. So take that, 90s.
Crazy. Casablanca is a 1942 American romantic drama directed by Michael Curtiz, starring Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman, and Paul Heinried. Filmed and set during World War II, it focuses on American expatriate Humphrey Bogarts, who must choose between his love for a woman or and helping her husband, a Czechoslovak resistant leader, escape from the Vichy-controlled city of Casablanca to continue his fight against the Nazis. The screenplay is based off of a unpublished play called Everybody Comes to Rick by Michael Murray Burnett and Joan Allison. The supporting cast features Claude Rains, Conrad Veidt, Sidney Greenstreet, Peter Lorre, and Dooley Wilson. So for me, Tommy, because I was thinking, like, what am I going to ask you about it? Was there a moment in Casablanca watching this movie for the first time that you went from, like, you're watching it, you're kind of, you're paying attention, but you're just watching the movie versus like, oh, I'm locked in. I'm completely drawn in. Was there a moment for you in this movie that just completely sucked you in and made you feel like you had to sit and watch?
I think it's the first flashback scene with, with all the characters like Humphrey Bogart and Mark Burman and Sam. They're all together and like it's the flashback and they talk about like them like leaving I think Europe at that point. And the way I mentioned this before, but just the way it draws you in, where like you see it, it's like they're very all from afar, wide shot, pretty much just like panned out as much as possible. And the camera just slowly pushes you right into the dialogue scene. And the way it just kept on cutting and cutting the people made me just like really interested. I think from a technical perspective, this movie's very interesting. And the way that drew me in, more so than the story on first watch, at least.
Interesting. So the story didn't really captivate you at all?
I think it was a combination of just like first watch and like trying to process all at once. So at first, I think it was still very interesting in terms of the story of like, oh, like the whole like escaping the Nazis. And it just kind of made me think like how insane it was that this movie was 1942, like we said, in the thick of World War II. And I kept on thinking, nagging me in the back of my head, as like, if we lost World War II, this movie probably would have been destroyed and just like never seen.
Yeah,
again.
Well, I mean, this is a very, like propaganda film. Like, there's a lot of everybody who's trying to. So, like, if you haven't seen Casablanca, everybody's trying to get out of there, right? Like, it's this last refuge city in the that's controlled by Vichy France. And if you're not familiar with Vichy France, when the Nazis got in, you know, took over. Captured France, there was the German occupied zone where Paris is, and then in the south there was the Vichy area, which was basically part of the compromise, which was like it's a free France, but it wasn't a free France. It was controlled by the Germans, but it was just like this. It was just so they didn't have to occupy this area. So there's this thing called the Vichy government for a couple of years until 1944. That government occupied in so. Casablanca was in that part of French Morocco was still under that Vichy era. So this is all like within the realm of like what is actually going on in the geopolitics of that time, right? Which is why the Germans aren't able to just take Victor Laszlo. I mean, they're the Nazis. They could have done it. You know, like it's like if you want to start really
with very British accents.
I mean, if you really wanted to start poking holes into the movie like that, like you would find it, but like I don't know. The story's got to happen somehow, right?
At the end of the day. And, I mean, perfect era villains right there, the Nazis. I mean, who worse than them?
There's just a lot of mentions, like, of all the characters going, like when they talk about America, they're talking about how excited they are to go. There's that elder German or Czech couple that are sitting there that are discussing it, and they're just like, we're only speaking in English now. We are so excited to go to America. I'm like, okay, like they're hitting the company lines there, right? Like there's definitely a little bit there, but I don't think it detracts, and I think it's a charm of the era, like when you're looking back on that, because like this is an entertainment product. Like you can sit there and be fully entertained, but there's now like the historical component of it, and then just like the film historical component of it, where all of it just kind of blends together to make it really fascinating to talk about.
Well, it definitely feels like from a film background perspective, you know, when we covered a movie like Dracula, for example, there's a quote going around that was like, basically the invention of sound set back the visual language of movies back by at least like five, six years. And you can see it, especially when you see like the old Universal horror movies, when you go from even just Frankenstein itself, Frankenstein, very shot statically, not camera doesn't move, just stays there. It's film and a play. And then you go to Bride of Frankenstein, all of a sudden it's like James Whale just like upgrade as a director, and the whole medium upgraded where all of a sudden you can cut to other things. You can zoom in, zoom out, go to here and there and stuff like that. And when you get to the point of Casablanca, it's even just more so up there.
It also should be noted that this, not that directors didn't have input, because obviously they did, but this is very much the era of the producer leading the show. Like, I think David Selznick is kind of infamously the most famous with Gone with the Wind. But like Hal Wallace was a big name at Warner Brothers at the time. So like when it came to writing the script, like they gave this adaptation to 20 writers in the Warner Brothers writing room. And then he picked and chose and kind of like Frankensteined the parts from all these different writers together. And that's how they kind of cobbled the movie together. It was actually a set of twins, Julius and Philip Epstein, who kind of became the primary screenwriters. They won an Oscar for their efforts here on this. But like the production of this is infamously kind of harrowed. Nobody fully believed in this movie, including Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, as I mentioned before.
Also, you had a director and like Michael Curtis, who like pretty much was just like a journeyman. Like you're saying at the beginning of the pod, like, you know, they used to pump out movies so much more.
It was
more
a factory.
More,
that's why a lot of it was stagnant. Like, yeah. It was just, you had to get this out in the theaters.
Yeah, exactly. So the point, Michael Curtis, over the course of his career, directed approximately 170 to 181 films from 1912 to 1961, like 50-year career. And we think about like Spielberg or Scorsese having a prolific like filmography. This guy like has a beat by like a fuck ton.
Yeah,
I feel like this is the main one that ended up surviving into like modern culture.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is just insane to think about.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of directors like that who have it. I mean, there's very few. Like, we talk about the early era of Hollywood, and you go into the history of it. Like, you have Cecil B. DeMille. You have some directors like Hitchcock is kind of like the godfather of like contemporary modern directing, but there's guys like Victor Fleming. Like, there's names that come around because they end up being attached to these larger projects. But they were the way we view direction and was not the way it was initially conceived as. It was this producer led thing here, but I think interesting points to talk about.
Well, it does also make you wonder if it does make you wonder about Michael Curtis, if like the guy like ever had a life outside of the set. If you direct like 170 movies, one after the other.
I mean, but they were filming these things in 3 weeks, you know, like they were filming it, and then it goes to editing, and then it goes into a theater. And, you know, we have to remember distribution at the time was very different. Like, Casablanca comes out in 1942. So it's going to be in New York and Los Angeles in 1942, and then it's going to caravan its way around the country for the remaining next couple of years. You know, that was the distribution system at the time. So it's interesting to talk about it, but we have to think about it from like the historical lens of like how these movies were, and especially like those early Oscars. It was more of an industry award than the way we view the Oscars today. Before that kind of became like the modern synonymous, because people didn't have access to these movies immediately. So if you're going to award the best movies of 1942, only like two or three cities really got to see the movie. No one else did.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think it's fascinating to talk about here, but the writers tried to get off of this movie at one point and then were pushed back onto it. Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman both tried to walk onto it because they did not know what they were going to do at the end of this movie with the love triangle. They were not sure how they were going to actually resolve it. And it was this like uneasiness, and Humphrey Bogart was apparently very grumpy and would kind of blow up a little bit on the sets on this movie. He just, but it's interesting. I think it's lightning in a bottle, right? We discussed this a lot of times with these kind of movies. It works in the movie's favor because Rick is a cranky guy.
Oh yeah, it plays off immediately to point. So you can understand immediately like why like Humphrey Bogart is the guy he is. He's just like a lovable grump in a way. And I just love like him just like walking around, just like mulling around, just always saying to Ingrid Bergman, just like, he's looking at you, kid, over and over again. And always just had a drink wherever, just relaxed in the environments where you should be panicking. It's like, the Nazis are coming, whatever. I'll be fine.
Well, I think it's...
Don't worry about me.
I think it's interesting. And I tried to watch it the second time as under the lens of, like, I've never seen this movie before and just trying to, like, lean into the emotion of, like, having the information revealed to me for the first time. Because it's hard to do that with movies, right? It's hard to, especially classics like this, that, like, I have seen this over and over again. It's hard to sit there and watch and like do that, but like one thing that really stood out to me, we talk about this from time to time, it's kind of dead in contemporary movies, but this has a great movie star shot. It's around the 9 to 10 minute mark of the movie where we are introduced to Rick, to Humphrey Bogart, where, you know, the first couple of minutes is just atmosphere laying. It's just setting out like what the political climate in Casablanca is, and we hear notes about these couriers who died, and there's papers that are missing, and we hear something about Rick's. We see the iconic outside of the cafe, and then we cut into the cafe, and we kind of see the music scene that's going on there. There's the casino, and that everybody's kind of trying to get a hold of Rick, but who is Rick? Who is this guy? We don't know who he is. And then the camera just over the shoulder, looking over as he's signing a document, you say, okay, Rick. And then it's just him with his cigarette there, his hand, and the camera just pans up as he's inhaling, just kind of like looking out away from the camera. And I'm just like, that is such a great introduction to a movie star. Like they have this perfected 30 years into the industry. And it's something that we've like lost, but I love that about this, where it's like, it was just like, the way it's presented is like, this is an important character, and we're going to emphasize the fact this is going to be the main draw of this movie.
Incredibly just draws you in. It's a point where like they know what they got of Humphrey Bogart at this point. This is a year after the Maltese Falcon. This guy's fucking riding hot. And what a performance. And I think just like everything, I didn't even realize that Peter Lorre was in this movie, a guy who like, we still know today because he's just referenced the Looney Tunes cartoons all the time when we were growing up.
Yeah.
That's how we just had our cultural osmosis.
Oh, yeah. Peter Lorre's only in this movie for the first act of it, right? He plays Ugarte, and he's this weird little, like, criminal guy. Like, we get all these examples of, like, people are hucksters here. People are trying to rip you off. This is not a safe place. I love how they kind of just set that ambiance there. And Ugarte, the first time we really get to see Rick there, and we kind of, what we learn what this character is, right? Where he's like this very diplomatic, pragmatist, like only interested in himself. But that little leak of sentimentality kind of reeks out there, like where his allegiances lie, because like he's going to toe the company line, right? Like he's going to be like, I have no interest in who wins and who loses the war. I'm a saloon keeper. Like, I don't want to be involved in this. And then with Ugarte, when he's like, I need you to hold on to these documents that he killed these two couriers for. And he's like, yeah, I do respect you a little bit more. There is a part of me that really wants to try to do a Humphrey Bogart's impression, but I just know.
It's almost like you want to do a 1920s gangster. That's my start. And yeah. It doesn't seem the same.
Yeah. Well, with someone like Humphrey Bogart, that is where he kind of like, he was a struggling play and film actor. Like, he kind of flip-flopped between LA and New York in the 20s and 30s, and until he got cast in gangster movies and they were like, oh, he just looks naturally right with a gun in his hand, is when his career kind of, because he became a big film star later in his career. Like, he wasn't one of those guys blessed at age 23 to have that breakout moment. Like, he worked for it. He was a constant grinder. And then he finally got to that point there. But there's just like those little cracks there that I love how they build that character up and just kind of like reveal him right there, where it kind of tells you everything you need to know, like where his head is at. And then you go, well, why is he such this pragmatist, right? Like, why is he so neutral? And then Ilsa and Victor Laszlo enter the saloon, and the answer is given to you right there. And I think that first night in the saloon is just like perfect. Like, we get all the little side characters, all the guys that are working in the staff, like all set up there. We get introduced to Captain Renal, played by Claude Rains, who is just, he's such a fantastic comedic character in this movie. Like, I love that performance every time I watch. Like, every time I watch this movie, I appreciate it more and more.
It's such an interesting performance, especially just because at the end of the movie, they're how they end up becoming like buddies. But I think that it was a slight little menace to him. Like, you're not entirely sure if he's just going to stick to the rules and just like take over. And I love the one scene where like they end up raiding the bar, and they tell the major tells Renhout like, just like find an excuse to like get just like arrest it, shut this down. And he's like, I can't believe you guys are gambling. Someone immediately hands him his gambling money. He's like, oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, and that was right after Rick and Laszlo are talking. Laszlo's trying to get the documents from Rick, and he's like, I won't sell them to you for $1 million. Ask your wife, right? Like, ask your wife why I won't give you this information. And I think, you know, he comes down out of his office and he hears the Germans singing some German anthem. And then Laszlo immediately goes to the other band. You know, the Germans are playing on the piano. He goes to the band and says, like, play the Nationalette and like a French anthem. And they all look to Rick. He nods and it goes. And it's, again, it's that like we know where his sympathies lie. And they just do such a good job of like throughout the movie of like little hints. Like, it's really clever, really strong screenwriting. And it also, it's like that's just such a great little moment, because we're learning with Rick, like, okay, he's like, throughout the movie, it's like he's the boss, and there's just all these like little moments of like everybody looks to him as a point of authority when they're in his saloon. And then there's just those little leaks of like where his sentimentality is, and he's just a heartbroken man who, you know, he was a gun runner, and then he was fighting for the nationalists in Spain during the Spanish Civil War in 1936. Like, he was this, you know, left-leaning, like, anti-fascist person, and it ends up, like, what happens to him in Paris with him and Ilsa, like, really just breaks his heart and makes him this, like, gruff man, but he still has these beliefs, right? And it's, like, this... the duplicity of Rick, and it's what makes him like an interesting character to discuss.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just like a multifaceted performance right there, where it's great. One character I really want to shout out to, especially because of the historical like implications of the time, Dooley Wilson as Sam.
Oh yeah,
one of the more famous lines in this movie is "Play it again, Sam."
Yeah,
and
from the beginning,
you know, I just think whatever, but like, For a movie like this, it feels like kind of like very like groundbreaking at the time, like having an African American like character that loved this prominence, that's not essentially just a servitude or a servant around the house or something like that. He has his own independence. He feels like Humphrey Bogart's best friend at this point. This is an era where, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, before this, was Gone with the Wind, where you had Hattie McDaniel, an actress who ended up was nominated for like Academy Award, and she
wasn't allowed to attend. Yeah. Which is crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So, insane to think about, but like, this movie though just gives Sam such a prominent performance.
It still has the racial tones of the time though, where he like Sam addresses all of the white characters as, "Oh, Mr. Rick. Oh, Mr. Laz." Like, you know, it's like that very like formal, and very like vaudevillian in his performance. But Sam is like a true friend, a true OG. Like.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
When Ilsa first comes into the bar, and then we watch Rick drinking, and he goes, "Of all the gin joints and all the towns and all the world, She walks into mine, and Sam is just sitting there being like, he's like, go home. And he's like, no, like that's his boy, you know, like that's his guy. And then you have, and then you have him in the flashback, at the end when he gets the letter, and he's just like, come on, like, what are you doing? Like, you have to leave. Like, let's go. Like, he's been with Rick throughout thick and thin. And it's just, it is such a great performance. It's smaller than
the chemistry between them. It's smaller in terms of like plot significance, but it still feels his presence throughout. Where like, you know, constantly thinking he was one of the main characters I took away from this movie was Sam himself. I think that he just gives like a great performance. Right, they're bros for life, essentially, him and Rick.
Yeah, and
they got each other.
What do you think's the most iconic for you on your first watch? Like, because like you've heard the lines, you've heard as time goes by, you know about the ending. What do you think? When you're watching this for your first time, what did you think the most iconic moment of the movie was?
Well, to be honest, I was very shocked. I didn't know the ending. I forgot the final line was, oh, like, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Like, I probably attribute that to some other movie. I definitely heard the line over the years.
Definitely, but in a Simpsons, you know, episode somewhere, you know, it's...
Oh, I'm sure it's been referenced like that. But I honestly thought this movie was going to end with them, like, together, Ingmar Bergman and Humphrey Bogart. And I was shocked at the end where it was just like, all these sisters, here's looking at you, kid. She goes on playing with Paul Hernad instead, Hern Reed instead. And Victor, I was like, wait, Laszlo. so that shocked me. But I think in terms of like most iconic moment, I think just the play it again, Sam scene is really powerful and a great vocal performance for Sam. And because I always started thinking about the historical like things of everything about this time. We're watching people from the 1800s act here, which is insane to think about.
But
that whole scene, they take you in. You just really close up on Ingmar Bergman's face as she's crying, thinking about this song and like the implications of what it means between her and Rick, and like, you know, how it plays a part in their history. And I thought it was a really powerful moment.
Yeah, I think it's number two for me. I think number one is that ending. It's just like the entire sequence, that entire third act sequence of right after Ilsa and Rick kind of have that like reconvening at night. And then he sets it up with Renal to come in, and he's going to do this arrest, right? Like from that point onward, where he double crosses Renal and gives, because in your first watch, when he says like, here, you can catch him in the act of me handing him the documents and you can just take him away, it gives Rick everything he needs. Like they can get out of Casablanca and Laszlo is out of their hair. They don't need to worry about it. And the way that it just like instantly turns on it, it's like, okay, back off now. You're going to make the call where he calls the German major, because like that is who this character is. I do think Renal is such an interesting character. This like toe-titling line where he's like, clearly his personal loyalties lie to France. But he goes wherever the wind blows, and he's trying to survive in this dark and dangerous city and keep his position of authority. And by doing so, he has to align with the Germans. And, you know, he's that teetotaler the entire time. And then all of a sudden...
Your question is like loyalty. Your question is loyalty a threat, because you could easily see him just being a stiff, wanting to just have a go.
Yeah.
So they go on to the rules.
Yeah. And I just love like him and Rick, just even though they weren't quote unquote friends, and it's a beautiful friendship at the beginning of the movie, but they just have a great rapport back and forth where he rigs roulette. He lets him win, you know, because that lets him keep the bar open and nobody's stopping the gambling that's going on in the back of the house. And just like all these, and like the way he goes around, like when he first meets Laszlo and he goes up and he's just like, oh, get the finest bottle, the 26 champagne, like put it on my tab. And they're like, oh, no, 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 we don't need to do that. He's like, oh, no, 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 it's okay. It's a little game Rick and I have where I pay it and I don't. And it's just like this delivery, like this, like there's something about that classical trained and this dialogue, like that classically trained actor and this dialogue, like just kind of like flows together like butter. It's so smooth. It feels like silk. Like it's all the dialogue feels very sharp, very fresh. And yet it feels of its time. In that sense, like it's just this crazy parallels between the two. Did you have that like feeling, that sensation while watching the movie?
I mean, some of the lines are iconic, and I definitely feel like I need another rewatch or two to like fully like appreciate the crackling dialogue that comes off. But I do love like some like parts of like, the movie where like, you just get the sense that everyone just hated Major Heinrich Strausser, and just a guy you just love to hate in this movie. Mm-hmm. What's insane about that actor's background, Conrad Veidt, was he, for an actor who played a bunch of Nazis in Hollywood, he was a refugee from Germany.
So is Paul Heinrich. There was a couple of European expatriates who were in these movies who fled the Nazis.
Yeah, which insane. You know, Veidt was like fleeing the Germany with his like Jewish wife and stuff like that, and then he comes back and he ends up being like typecast as like these villains in these movies. He was the highest paid member of this cast, even though he was second billing, which. Again, insane, because you'd think that like Humphrey Bogart would be the highest paid, but
it's a different time because they're all these actors are not. Katharine Hepburn changed the game in the 60s when she was the first actress to get $1 million for a single film. They were under weekly contracts that would be renegotiated depending on how movies did and how they performed. So that is. It's tougher to say like, oh, he was the highest. Well, he was just the highest paid person at the time that the movie was being filmed. He was therefore the biggest star at the time, even though he wasn't the star in the movie, but that's what his contract demanded. So it's just these like little like differences of that studio era that fill into this versus, you know, how we view it, where it's like Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman would easily be the highest paid if this movie was being made today in the way movies today.
Insane that like the whole studio system that like, you know, all these actors were contracted to a specific studio, and like very rarely could you go to another.
They're loaned out.
They're loaned out. This is what happened for Ingmar Bergman, where the producer of this movie, Hal Willis, obtained the services of Bergman because she was contracted to David O. Selleck, and then he was like, "Here, I'll give you Olivia de Havilland in exchange for Ingmar Bergman in my movie."
Ingrid Bergman.
Ingrid Bergman. Yeah.
It's usually me we have to worry about with the pronunciations, Tommy. It's funny how that like magic happens here. I mean, we haven't really talked about Ingrid Bergman as Elsa, but she brings this like sensitivity and just beauty to probably, and like elevates, I would say probably the most underwritten part of the character is Elsa, because she's just. She's a little bit damsel in distress in this movie, you know, where she doesn't have a ton of agency. It's a lot of like, oh, be careful, Victor. It's a lot of those lines. But like we see through this character that like she's attracted to men that have a certain, her character is attracted to men that have a certain political stance and like a strength behind them. And a conviction in what they're doing and what they believe in. And like between what we know about Rick and what we know about Victor Laszlo, that kind of, you know, connection and just like what she's attracted to. And just like, when you think about what those guys are going through in the ringer and just what they're doing, like having someone that gentle and warm to come home to, right? And like, we have to think about it in the times of the 1940s, right? When we're thinking about these kind of movies, like it just like, she just brightens up the screen. Like everything about her just makes you.
Well, her chemistry with Humphrey Bogart is just sizzling like off the screen. And you can see why this is one of the more like iconic like movie romances we've seen out there. Because immediately, like, they just, like, you could see it, like, in this flashback scenes where they're together and talking about wanting to flee fascists and how, like, Humphrey Bogart, like, used to, like, hate fascists, used to fight them all the time. And he's like, what do I care? But again, like, the interplay just, like, makes it really compelling.
Yeah, it is really compelling in that way. How did you feel about the pacing of this movie?
It was all right. It was
really
right. I think the pacing, yeah. I think that if there's any flaw on first watch, I agreed with our guest last week, John. John from the Pint and Pop Culture podcast was like, I kind of found it a little boring at parts. I think there was a little stretch where I was like, okay, like I wish it could have been sped up a little bit, or maybe like just like paced a little bit better, slightly. But I think this is also first watch jitters when I'm a little tired. I'll admit, like I'm very exhausted on this recording right now. And I think on a second watch, I'd be like, okay, maybe I could appreciate more. But first watch, I was like, all right, like,
if you're watching the video of this, you can see the bags under Tommy's eyes. Like, you can definitely see them. But for me, it just flies by. Like I when we were watching the first watch through, we paused at like the 30-35 minute mark, and I thought we were like 15 minutes into the movie. Like, I could not believe how quick it went. I don't think there's any fat on this movie. Like, I don't think there's anything that you need to chop off and make it go quicker. Like, I think it's a perfect movie.
I didn't feel anything similar to like when we cover like Barry Lyndon, for example. Like, I didn't feel like I was like checking my clock.
That one's like 3 hours, and it's just like Stanley Kubrick going like, what if every shot was a Renaissance painting? And that's cool, but it ignored the story quite a bit.
Exactly. Whereas this one didn't have that, but like it jumped from scene to scene. I definitely think that I just hit a wall, like outside of the movie. Mm-hmm. Just like immediately like had me like struggling where I was like, okay, fuck, like now I'm watching this right now. again, that's what I think rewatches are meant for me sometimes with older movies, to appreciate them fully.
I should have said to you, like, try to watch this one twice. And then there was the guy who owned, Signor Ferrari, who owned the Blue Parrot. There's just one line that always stuck out to me where Laszlo and Ilsa go to him looking for her visas out of Casablanca. And he's like, I run all things illegal here in Casablanca. I was like, okay, well, that's a little on the nose, huh? Like, that line is just so funny in this movie where it's like, and maybe like when you think about like America at the time, like the world of the under, it's not as fresh with us, especially like in light of recent news that has come out with certain documents being linked, wink, wink, nod, nod. But like this kind of like dark underbelly of our world, I don't think was as prevalent in American society here. So it almost needed to be hinted at. And like, what does this guy do? Okay, he runs the illegal stuff. Let's just have him say it. That way it's just like brass off the nose. I just thought that was funny. Yeah. But I thought he was like I could see those being scenes where you're just like, okay, but I just think it adds to the world of Casablanca, right? Like, there's more to this world outside of Rick's cafe. Like, there's just all the seediness there, and it adds to the danger of where they are.
Well, it also, I think, just like makes great use of its setting, where like you see like multiple parts of this bar and throughout, and they don't just shoot it from one angle. Again, like, mm-hmm. This is the main takeaway for me, like, this time on this first watch, cinematography, how they just go and like zoom in on like Sam playing on the piano, zoom out to everyone in the bar, like being associated and like just being lively. You can really feel the energy in a room that sometimes I feel like in older movies, it feels almost like stagnant. Too hokey to feel like something really happening. It's stagnant. Yeah. And this didn't have this hokey nature to it.
And I think in like the lines of that with like the cinematography, like I feel like Rick's American Cafe, you can map out the entire bar and the geography of that bar just based on how it's shot, because you get to see it from every angle. It's kind of like your point is making me think of like 12 Angry Men, where that movie is shot in one room, the entire movie. And this one, a good chunk of it is shot entirely in one room, basically. You can make one room very interesting if you know how to shoot it, and you have your narrative kind of like weave into that, and you can use your camera like that, and it's these like building blocks that lead into the world of cinema that we're more common to from the 70s, 80s, 90s onwards, right? Like all of these are like building blocks, and I don't think there's any fat on this movie, though, to your point.
Okay.
Yeah.
I definitely think it's just a matter of like the fact also this movie is not 2 hours over, 3 hours over. They get in and out in like about what, 100 minutes or so.
Yeah, a little which, of like 105 or something like that. It's trim. This will make me very excited to do like Gone with the Wind with you, where that is 3 hours and 49 minutes.
Yeah. And that's gonna be one I'm gonna be like save until like the night of recording.
There's like a clear intermission break in that, and I would almost argue like watch the first half, pause it, come back to it, watch the second half. Like I would just like for time's sake, like 4 hours is where for me it's like. You know me, I love the Lord of the Rings movies. I don't love the extended editions, you know? Like, I'm just like, okay, like, the real 4.5 hours, yeah. Return of the King. Oh, God.
It's like, you ever see, like, Once Upon a Time in America, the De Niro movie by Sergio Leone that's, like, 4 hours long? I watched it with my family, like, and we were, like, just about the end, just, like, getting punched almost
just on the length of it. Yeah, I think it's one of the reasons I never watched Once Upon a Time in America is because of the length of it, where I'm just like, oh God, that's a commitment. That's a real commitment.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe not fully worth it.
Oh, interesting. Hot take.
I am a star. I'm a star, I'm a star, I'm a star. I am a big, bright, shining star.
That makes me really want to cover Once Upon a Time in America now, just so that you have to sit through a four-hour movie again. You'll have to commit 8 hours of your entire life, a full working day, to Once Upon a Time in America.
Hell yeah. Just get me in.
Just get you in. Get you locked in. Who's the star of the show, Tommy? Which performance to you stood out? Because we talked a lot about the performances here, but like, who do you think is the real star here?
I think of Ingrid Bergman, because like in order to have a good convincing love triangle, Isabel Rossellini's mom.
Yes.
Yeah. In order to have like a compelling love triangle, you really need someone like great in the center, and she is someone great. You can see why both these guys like want her and like want to be with her and stuff like that, and like why there's maybe not like a ton of like fighting, but like the fact that like okay, like this is someone that's like magnetic. And just the interplay she has with Humphrey Bogart, I think, is just fascinating. A great little back and forth they have right there. And even if Paul Hernandez is slightly different, you'd see it in the end of the movie when Humphrey Bogart tells her, hey, like, I'm not coming to America with you. You could just feel the heartbreak in her eyes alone.
Yeah.
Great acting, great eye acting, great listening acting.
Yeah, and I love that little, you might not regret it right now, but one day, a month, and a year from now, you will regret it. Like, it's just one of those great lines. And then that here's looking with you, kid. Just so for me, I think it's Humphrey Bogart with a big honorable shout out to Claude Rains. I think Rick is a really tough character to cast right. Like, it needs to be like a man's man that's willing to crack a little bit of the sentimentality there. And I love how we've heard here's looking at you, kid, like three or four times throughout the movie at that point. But the way he says it, the final time he's talking to her, it just hits like a roller punch. I mean, both of these performances are great. I just think so much of the movie hinges on Rick. And I just think that performance is so iconic and so vital to the movie itself that I think you could take some other classical, you know, golden age movie actresses and maybe put them in Ingrid Bergman's place and it might work. I don't know who you're putting in Humphrey Bogart's place. Could you imagine James Stewart with his, like, I love Jimmy Stewart. You think this would work with his accent?
No, it'd take you out immediately. I think that there's a gravitas of Humphrey Bogart brings to your picture.
Yes. There's that gravitas. There that he definitely has.
Ah, are you ready, comedy partner? Waka waka.
Okay. All right, Tommy. Would Casablanca work as a Muppet adaptation?
I think incredibly so. It's a classic movie that I feel like they probably already have parodied. Speaking of like pop culture osmosis, like one of the things I remember of Casablanca was Space Jam: A New Legacy, when they pull up to Yosemite Sam and he's like, they say play it again, Sam. It's Yosemite Sam instead of Sam from this movie. Just a really dumb gag from that movie that I saw opening night.
I watched like a quarter of it and I like couldn't get through that movie. That's an incredible bit. That's an incredible bit.
It's an incredible like 5 minute stretch of the movie that you wish the rest of Space Jam: A New Legacy was like that. Really, just insert Looney Tunes characters in iconic movies where you have like Wile E. Coyote and Mad Max briefly, and he's like one of the guys. Like, okay, that makes sense. That's amazing. It has like a Matrix parody of Granny, which is like so stupid but like incredible at the same time. And then it comes to like Yosemite Sam and Casablanca. It's like, what the fuck are we doing? Warner Brothers just raiding their library, their entire stock.
Yeah. We might be the only humans on the planet Earth that have recorded a conversation about the movie Casablanca and connected to Space Jam: A New Legacy.
Yeah. Similar
quality for sure. Just Piggy going, play it again, Rolf. Play as time goes by, and just Rolf there on the puppets, trinkling the keys. Like, I feel like it has to be Kermit and Piggy. No.
Immediately. Who else could it be? Because then
it could be Sam. Could be Sam the Eagle. Like, if you're gonna do like the only like real American in the movie is Sam, or is Rick. Which, and I guess Sam. We actually don't know enough about Sam, but let's just assume he's American. That they've just been boys. Like, they got in trouble in the U.S. They went to Europe, and they just took it from there. You know.
Dare you say though that Sam the Eagle has Humphrey Bogart energy?
I think of all the Muppets, he probably has the most of it. He's the most stoic of all of them. You know what I mean? Where it just like, I don't know if it works with Kermit. Like, I feel like Kermit as Paul Heinrich is more the right fit there, you know, as Victor Laszlo. Like, I feel like that's more of a Kermit position.
Then you keep Claude Rains. He's the one human.
I was thinking Fozzie, but yeah, if I'm keeping one human, I'm keeping Claude Rains for sure. For sure. Review time, Tommy. Give me your score out of 5. I will judge you.
All right. I can see why Casablanca is like considered a classic. I think it's a movie that I'm going to need another watch to like fully appreciate and soak in. And this first thing, cinematography, just blew me away. Like, the things they're able to pull off the camera right there. I think the central like performances are just really charming. But on first watch, there's a little part where some parts got a little disengaged or wasn't fully on board. So I'm going to go 4 out of 5 with the caveat that I will watch this again and I'm sure that will improve.
All right. So I think a perfect movie. It's 5 out of 5 for me. I said in my notes, I think I could watch this movie every week. Everything about it feels effortless and timeless, yet of its time, which I think is just like somehow incredible. Like, they didn't make this movie with the thought of how people in the year 2026 would react or think about it. I think they will be talking about this movie 80 years from now. Casablanca. If you haven't, you've seen Casablanca. Only person on planet Earth who hasn't seen it is Tommy, okay? Everybody else has seen
Apparently.
It. Every other human being has seen it.
That's like a film 101 right there.
Phil, you missed out on film school, Tommy. Any final thoughts before we wrap up this episode?
Well, thank you guys so much for listening. You can find us on social media. That's at CNAPod. That's on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. We're also on Blue Sky at podcna.bluesky.social. And leave us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Helps us out. Helps us grow the show. I know Timmy is really disappointed he couldn't play the Al Pacino soundbite right here. Okay. He thought it was going to be a slam dunk.
I thought it was going to be a slam dunk already. Oh.
Yeah. Next time. Maybe next week. Next week, I'm throwing an audible. I pitched this movie earlier. It just celebrated its 35th anniversary. It is a cable classic. Sleeping with the Enemy, one of Julia Roberts' first starring movies. I think we should cover it. Seems appropriate. Came out 35 years ago. It used to be playing on like TBS all the time. I've never seen it. I doubt you've seen it.
I remember it on TNT and TBS.
Exactly.
Thank you all so much for listening. We will see you next week.